have about an hour, and I think we, war is hell, and I don't mean that, to take that lightly, right? We're talking about a crisis. Thousands of people have been killed, millions displaced. But it's kind of what Matt and what Kusei, everybody alluded to. The question is, what do you do about it? What should your stance should be? And part of that is a question of reality and whether you want to debate how many numbers there are. There's people that have died, and they've died in specific locations, and they've died because of some condition. So we can't answer all those questions in the hour tonight, but one thing I do hope you take with you is that you also can't expect that the media on its face will give you an adequate understanding. You have to have some kind of frame to understand their frame. Enough said. Let's see if you have questions for any of the speakers or a general question for...
That's a go. When you have a few minutes, I would like to talk about this one, if you don't mind, just for a few minutes.
Sure, maybe there will be a question that you can speak to that. Yes?
I was going to ask you to respond.
Okay. Well, that map, I withdraw. So. By the way, I've been to Syria during this war for like 8 times. Last time I was there 5 months ago. And 5 bombing took place in my city. One of them was at the ER. 86 people died at the emergency room. This is Turkey here, on this side, which is the north side of Syria. And this red spot here showing where the refugee camps were built in the second half of 2010, preparing for the Arab Spring 2011. So they know they want to take the Syrian people out of their country into these camps to use it as an excuse by the international law to go attack Syria and have non-fly zone for Turkey, all this Syria area. That's the purpose of these refugees were built. Same thing goes here on the south with Jordan. They did the same thing. And there is probably 700,000 people or more on this side and that side. They are mostly women and children. The husband of and the kids who's old enough to fight, they are fighting against the Syrian government. This is the red line show you where the terrorists are. They started with Dara in Jordan. I mean, in Dara next to Jordan border. By the way, all the protesters in Syria came out of the mosque. The mosque never been a place for revolutions. So they never came out of culture center or school or university or anything like that. They just came out of mosque trying to impose the Wahhabism system of the kingdom of Terra, which is Saudi Arabia. This is Lebanon. Right now, this border here, it's like 80% is clear of terrorists after the Syrian army and the Lebanese worked together against the terrorists here. This is the refugee camp in Jordan still there where the sheikh came from the Gulf country, 60, 70, 80 years old, getting married to a Syrian girl between 8 and 15 years old, buying her for $50 or $40, you know, depends. Here is Iraq. All this red arrow shows you the attack Syria is in front of. Here, the Syrian Turkish came in. They control most of these areas. Here, they came in from Iraq and Mosul, taking all this distance to Palmyra City, 150 miles. And the satellites were watching. The American satellite was watching them. They did nothing to them, and they occupied Palmyra. And here, next to Jordan, Saudi Arabia, where they have the cargo airplane goes to Ukraine, load up with weapons, comes and lands in area here called Tabuk, go through Anbar, Providence, and Iraq, and come into Syria. So all these red things, it's nothing but terrorists. This area here, where is the Syrian coast, where I am from right here, there is about 3 to 4 million refugees from Hama, from Palmyra, from Raqqa, from Aleppo, and Idlib. Last few days, the Syrian army were able to release about 80,000 civilian Syrians from the terrorists in Aleppo. So far, the United Nations did not give any help. The Syrian brought food with the help of Russia and the hospital fields. Here's the United Nations at the current issue is not taking a referee side or referee position. They're always in support of the terrorists. Stefan de Mistura lately asked the Syrian government to respect the terrorist dignity while they are leaving Aleppo. And also he asked for autonomy for them. It's like, imagine if I have a couple hundred Syrians here in Chicago or in Indiana, I will ask the United States to have a country for us, like for 200-300 people. That's what the United Nations were looking to do in Syria. Of course, why? Because the United States government needs the war to keep on and on and on, so the Syrian government could give up and surrender. But during my trips to Syria, I have seen Syrian people willing to fight this all the way to the end, because it became a holy war. They are defending the humanity against the enemy of the humanity. Aleppo, I think 2 weeks should be over. The terrorists will be going out of it. All Damascus suburb, now it's clear. Some of them threatened their weapons, and some of them want to Idlib in Raqqa. Right now, it's the capital of Islamic country, Raqqa. They have Muslims from all over the world, even from Chechnya. We have 100 countries fighting in Syria, fighting the Syrian national government. So that's what the Syria facing. It's international plot, but I believe the Syrian willing to win this because they have the right against the terrorists.
The narrative that we're given here is that there is no Syrian civil war, and there never was a struggle for democracy in Syria. That what we have is a struggle between a war between the legitimate government of Assad and a bunch of terrorists. And everybody in Aleppo, for example, is apparently a terrorist.
I'm not finished.
Excuse me. Well, let's start by challenging the narrative that's been given here by asking, who fights for Assad? In fact, you said early on that Assad wouldn't have been able to stay in power for 6 years if the Syrian people weren't supporting him. But in fact, Assad was about to be overthrown by the Syrian people when Russia intervened and turned the tables. Let me finish. 90% of the fighters, for I don't know the precise number, obviously, but overwhelmingly the people fighting for Assad are Iranian militia, Iranian regular forces and special forces. We now hear a lot about Iranians sending Afghan refugees, training them, sending them into Syria, and of course Hezbollah from Lebanon, which is supplied by Iran. All of these, none of these people are Syrians, and Russia, the Russian Air Force, none of these, that's not Syrian. The Syrian army is a minor part of this. Overwhelmingly, Assad is supported by external forces. Now, obviously, there are terrorists who have ISIS, Al-Qaeda, but we're asked to believe that the United States is actually aiding and supplying Al-Qaeda and ISIS. That's what we've just been told.
That's very
because
good.
All of the... Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You
right.
Finished?
It's a cynical lie. No, I'm not finished. No, I'm not finished.
Try to wrap it up, if you would. We've got other people that want to ask questions.
I know that, and I'm not going to go on for a long time.
Go
but
on.
You say you want to hear an alternative narrative, and I'm the only person giving it.
Get to it. Get to it.
So far. I have supported the U.S. establishing a no-fly zone in Syria. Let me make this clear. I opposed the U.S. intervention in Iraq strongly, and I would oppose any U.S. intervention in Syria. I recognize the reality of U.S. imperialism. I don't have time to go into all that.
That's nice.
A reality.
I'm glad
that's
you don't.
A reality. But the reality is that since imperialism, Russian, U.S. imperialism, now Russian imperialism has intervened, and the United States has been willing, got outplayed because they were sort of hesitant after the debacle in Iraq, and Russia moved in, took advantage of that. And there was apparently some debate inside the United States. Everybody remembers the indecision around Obama's red line. And the result is that apparently the United States decided to stand by and let Russia destroy the democratic revolution in Syria, do the dirty work. And then I don't know what the plan would be after that, but obviously the danger of war between the United States and Russia is there. But for now, they will let Russia do the dirty work. Yeah, I do support, I have supported the establishment of a no-fly zone. This may be now kind of a dated demand.
Questions, ask questions, so we can have time.
I'm going to continue speaking.
Please, there's many people here. Ask a few questions.
Could you wrap it up so we can move on?
Yes, I'll wrap it up. There is nothing wrong with calling on the United States to establish a no-fly zone. I can make a simple analogy. If there's a labor strike and the company is hiring thugs to beat up strikers, there's nothing wrong with calling on the bourgeois government, the capitalist government, to enforce its law. There's nothing wrong with demanding that imperialism uphold international law and stop the bombing of civilians.
Russia is bombing civilians.
Russia is bombing civilians.
I don't have time to keep listening to you.
They have killed 500,000 people.
Sit down, I'll answer you. Sit down, please. We have 1 hour. There's 50 people. Don't listen. Okay, I'll answer. Yeah, okay, listen.
I'm listening very carefully, but you're lying.
Yeah. Don't call me a liar.
I will call you a liar.
Fine, that's different. I'm here for a mission. I'm not going
to
let you close. Sit down and listen to me.
This way by liars.
Yes. So if I could go to a question for the students' papers, I apologize that I was came late. My name is Dr. Neymar out here. Apropos to nothing, question. So this Netflix thing is so interesting because, and I'm so glad I can, because this is like the area in which I can maybe comment, but I think it really is neat because it links to some stuff I saw in Dakota Access Pipeline, something that our guest maybe can even speak to from his on-the-ground experiences, and something that actually Dr. Arts can speak to. I know he's busy. And you can too, which is like when people are in crisis, this map shows. And Standing Rock is also in a similar vein. And then Dr. Arts was in Nicaragua when there was a major crisis of communication. People find really interesting and unique ways to get their messaging out to each other. So your piece is looking at and doing, you know, a good analysis of the messaging that's coming out, and as well as the economic of Netflix as a global power. When you said, like, hey, they gave, you know, they didn't put in labor, they didn't have to pay for labor, but they put in equipment. So, like, what are some ways that people are communicating to each other? And then were you able to find out, like, how this equipment coming from Netflix to do videos became a part of the community making media out there and, you know, getting used for Netflix views but also for Netflix distribution?
That's the thing. It didn't. And I have no idea what, like, the media that, how they're using their media in Syria. This came directly to an already, to the White Helmets, a government, a U.S.-sponsored, quote-unquote, NGO. So they said, hey, we want to make a documentary about you because you're famous over here in the U.S. We know that it would get a lot of views, that it would be very popular with our viewers. So here is this equipment to make that happen.
Not really, but...
mostly state-controlled.
Not really.
It's mostly state-controlled, you said, Matt?
Yeah, at least... Sorry, I'll explain.
No, it's fine. You know better than me.
No, I apologize.
No, go ahead.
No.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, of the groups who I've talked to, there's a lot of informal independent media on the ground in Syria. In the aftermath of the Arab Spring, there were numerous local coordination committees that were set up in cities all across the country to establish independent social media, independent news outlets, independent action news in the events of things getting bloody by street fights between the various factions, some of which died soon after the Arab Spring, some of which continue operational to this day under new names. One that I can think of immediately off the top of my head has been a online community called Plant Syria, which has reporters reporting all across the country, some in rebel-occupied territories, some in government-controlled territories. Very difficultly, but they try to at least get small stories of stuff happening on the ground on a regular basis. Otherwise, there are independent Kurdish outlets, which are another source that I've found at least.
Yeah, that's right. I have a few things. If anybody's interested, you can leave me your email. I have a few things, references to some of the articles that I referred to in the New York Times, National Catholic Reporter, which has a totally different perspective, more in line with what the gentleman you heard here, that's the debate within the Catholic institutions between some different points of view. But I mentioned this because I also have an article on local councils that were established as part of the Arab Spring that continue to exist both inside and outside opposition-controlled areas, and there's some interesting information. Not a lot on media, but you can kind of figure out that there's some local media that is online and others that are available. But I'd be happy to share that with you, too. Do we have other? Yes.
I have a question about framing. And I'd like to start off by saying I watch the news every single night, ABC 7 Chicago and ABC 7 or ABC the National News, primarily to make fun and poke fun at the news. It's a hobby of mine. But concerning whether it's print media or media on TV or even a Netflix documentary, do they frame certain situations such as the situation in Syria for the purpose of profit and ratings, or to promote a certain viewpoint? And if they're promoting a certain viewpoint, do they do it for their own benefit or in collusion with another organization?
Well, I guess it would. It would depend on who you ask.
Some of the research that I looked at was talking about media feeds off of crisis. There has to be something sensational in order for it to make money off of that. So one of the things that was said in a lot of the research was that they sensationalize things that might be to the benefit. First of all, you have to think about who owns it, so it might be to their benefit. You have
Disney.
To think about where the... Huh?
Disney owns it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, in addition, Raquel talked about there are six corporations that own media in the United States. So, some of the research I read talked about the fact that they need to make a crisis appealing to their viewers. So, saying it in a way that it may not necessarily be in direct collusion with someone, but it could be just to attract viewers, to keep viewers, and to kind of reinforce the ideals of the
dominant narrative.
The dominant narrative, that's the word.
So earlier this semester, right, I made a small media model of how, in my mind, mushrooms, right, were like trees. I mean, mushrooms were like media and trees were like the government. And again, depends on who you ask, but from my perspective, one feed the other. And that, at least in the case here with Netflix, that Netflix is not going to put out anything, any content that is going to dissent from their direct interests. And all media corporations, please, for the love of God, keep this in your mind, that all media corporations are what they are, businesses. And what is the goal of a business? The goal of a business is to make money. Like, right? So either it is ethical or unethical, depending on who you ask, that they are doing that, right? Because they have a direct interest to serve their own interests and those of their shareholders, etc. also, I think that so they're not going to put out any content that goes against that or goes too much content that goes against the more dominant narrative that usually is in support of the U.S. as well.
Talking about the media in Syria and Iraq, how it's reported here, I'm kind of amazed even today, even after the stories about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction 15 years ago, they were totally invented and sold to us by almost all the media. Now, if we remember a couple of years ago, a lot of Syria and Iraq was under control of ISIS. Now they're being fought against in Iraq and Mosul and in Syria in this East Aleppo, basically the same situation where they're being bombed and surrounded and attacked. But if I read the newspapers in Mosul, it's like all the civilians being killed, which I think is 900-something now, it's because ISIS there uses them as human shields, and so it's not the U.S. or the Iraqi army's fault, because what can they do? These people are being human shields by ISIS. But in Aleppo, It's the same ISIS, but I guess they're not using human shields. The Syrian government and all these allies and the Russians are just killing them all indiscriminately. It's kind of amazing. It's the same thing going on in both cities, but how it's presented in the U.S. media. It's like the good guys are bombing them and killing them in Mosul, and the bad guys are doing that in Aleppo. And it's also, remember, I've read recently that allegedly a quarter of a million people in Aleppo are supposed to be dying anytime soon because of starvation and bombing. And I bet I like to see in like another 3 weeks when it's finally freed of these ISIS groups, how many people have actually died in ISIS in Aleppo.
Well, is it contradictory to condemn both the conduct of coalition forces in Mosul as well as of Syrian and Russian forces in Aleppo? No. I mean, is it contradictory to both criticize and condemn both how the coalition has conducted itself in Mosul on the one hand and how Syria and Russia have conducted themselves in Aleppo? No. I mean, international law is pretty clear. Protection must be afforded to civilians, no ifs, ands, or buts.
International law means no foreign interference in the country. What about the international law that says that Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and the United States...
The responsibility is on the attacking party, regardless of if they're there legally or not. When you bomb the six existing hospitals in Aleppo, which had been, for all intents and purposes, still under civilian control, I mean, these weren't occupied by physical rebel soldiers 24/7. And again, I'll read the actual statute to you.
I'd like to take a few minutes.
Article 18 and 19 of the 4 Geneva Conventions makes it clear, unless they are actually being used for current military operations out of the hospital facility itself, they are untouchable, period. Now, if Russia and Syria claim that they were being used by rebel forces, the burden of proof's on them to produce the evidence that it was being used as staging grounds for rebel operations. But when you bomb the six existing only civilian hospitals in Aleppo, that constitutes a war crime.
You know, I did see something on the news, YouTube, a couple days ago, saying that the stories of the last existing hospital in East Aleppo being bombed. It's a story, it's like 20 different news stories over the last 6 or 7 months.
I'm going off of what MSF puts out. Doctors Without Borders?
Hospital in Aleppo was bombed. They just keep repeating that story about every week. I don't know, you don't say anything about the U.S. bombing that hospital in Afghanistan.
No, that was abysmal. Kunduz, Kunduz was a war crime.
The Russians
and I will equally condemn the bombing of Kunduz.
But I didn't hear you say that.
But there's panels on Syria. That's the thing. Like, if you want to have a panel on that, I'd be willing to have a criticized U.S. foreign policy there, too. But I'm simply applying a uniform principle, which is when you cross this line, you should be held accountable to it. Period.
I have a different answer. What's going on in Syria has nothing to do with the international law as acts by U.S. and other, because if it was international law or someone respecting the international law, they will not invade Syria. Huh? Let the sky rain on Syria. 360,000 terrorists from all over the world. The same terrorist who's killing in Aleppo, in Damascus, in Idlib, and other. In Syria, he's not terrorist. He's a free fighter. But the same one in the U.S., like the one in Ohio the other day, who killed the kids in Ohio, and like France, London, there are terrorists there. It's the double standard of the United States and the United Nations and the Security Council. The Syrian government never bombed the hospital. The terrorists who did bomb the hospital. I'm not talking to you. Let me finish. I have people on the ground, and I've been there 7 times. You and him and others taking your news from the media. It's all been fabricated. You have to know. The United States government wants you to know what they want you to know. They don't want you to know the reality. The reality, people. I'm not talking to you, man.
Please don't.
That's a double standard by the United States. Double standard by the NATO's countries and the Security Council. The United Nations mission is to solve problems between countries. In the case of Syria, they are helping the terrorists. Can you imagine the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations, Dr. Jafari, his son, graduated from the high school? No American college except him? Is that supposed to be a freedom and democracy? Come on. Why? Because he did not defect from his country, from his government. So now his son is out of the country studying because U.S. will not accept him. Also, they put travel restrictions on him. He cannot go out of his office more than 22 miles. You know, they're trying to put pressure on the Syrian. But the Syrian, they're really now, after 6 years, just insisting to fight it. Let me answer a few questions,
I'll be glad to answer.
For democracy in Syria, you're looking for democracy in Syria. And the Syrian people...
Certainly not under Assad.
I don't want to get in a conversation with him.
Lee, you're an irrelevant person.
I'm not
going to
do one
minute. I
don't want you to answer him directly.
Okay. I won't look at him.
Well, let's control this discussion very carefully. Let's not allow alternative points of view to be heard, because we've only heard one.
Yes, I want to ask Mr. Matt, I think. You mentioned in your presentation about the right for Kurds to make a country or something like that.
Well, they have at least some minimum rights, again, under international law, but if they have claims to, at minimum, statehood, or at the very least, reparations from crimes committed against them.
What about the Palestinian?
Same thing. I would wholeheartedly endorse.
You don't say that.
Oh, fine. I'll say it right now. The Palestinians deserve recognition, period. And unfortunately, international law hasn't gotten up to date with the times. We live in a world now where whole peoples do not have statehood and hence do not have legal recourse to the United Nations because they have no country to point to as, here we are, here's our government, let us seek some recognition in the larger international community. Palestinians, the Kurds, until very recently, the South Sudanese. Unfortunately, we need to seriously rethink how international law is going to work in the 21st century, and for many non-state actors who, up until now, are facing a very uneven playing field, they're going to continue being sort of languishing in this limbo of they're not quite random disparate peoples, but they're not quite states with the same rights.